Kevin Phillips has done us the honor to be back for the third time, a rare treat for us. Fourth time, excuse me.
I think that's right.
Many
I think
times.
So, certainly, I think, yeah.
Well, we'll
yeah.
just start that again. Kevin Phillips is setting a record with us here on the Paula Gordon Show, a fourth return. We are delighted to have you back, Mr.
Happy
Phillips.
Happy to be here.
Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. Bill talked about these two numbers that jumped out at him. What jumped out at me was the enormity in thinking about what you call the Anglo-Saxon way of thinking about the financial world and a state capitalism, a private market-driven capitalism and a state capitalism that is transforming much of how the world goes about the really basic things that we have decided that we need, like resources. That portends an enormous threat, challenge, change, opportunity, doesn't it?
I think at this point it's more of a threat than it is an opportunity. The Anglo-Saxon brand of capitalism, which is essentially a stock market as opposed to bank and bureaucratic continental European approach, goes back actually beyond the British to the Dutch in the 17th century. They had the first bank in Amsterdam. Well, it wasn't called the Bank of Holland, but it was essentially a central bank, and they had the first bourse stock market of the sort we would recognize today. And then as they started to decline, a lot of their connections and techniques and everything shifted to Britain.
Literally.
And the Bank of England and the stock markets and all of that was an extension, in a lot of ways, of Dutch finance. And the United States was always extending Dutch and British finance in the mind of Alexander Hamilton and other people who had exactly that sort of pattern. And what you got out of the Dutch and the British and the Americans was a speculative variety of finance, not the sort that exists with banks and cartels of industry like you'd get in Germany or Japan. And I think the long and the short of it is it's been a dangerous development. The British did not go down because they had wacko speculative finance. They just borrowed too much money and spent too much money in two wars. But the United States has indulged in ways that nobody ever has before, with everything from almost self-destructing mortgages that they should have known wouldn't work, but they just set something up that they could sucker people with. An incredible number of screwball, and then some not so screwball, financial derivatives and structured products, and some of the names will ring bells, like, you know, collateralized debt obligations, which have turned out to be wired like bombs and go off all over the world, and just lots of things that were irresponsible. The British were irresponsible in terms of letting themselves get sucked into too much of a role overseas and then wars and everything. But we've created stuff that almost renders you unfit to have, in my opinion, world economic leadership and to let all this garbage develop the way it has. And that's what you get when so much money has been pushed into finance. Because when people have a lot of money in finance, what they do is they leverage. And you can make an awful lot of money off an eighth of a point if instead of investing $3 million, you borrowed enough so that you're investing $90 million.
Well, the greed factor, the human nature factor, does tend to get into play here, doesn't it?
In overdrive.
And then there is magical thinking.
Yeah. Well, the worst thing is that you had, and the United States was unfortunately the laboratory, in the sense of Frankenstein's laboratory, of the rise of floating currencies after the United States closed the gold window in 1971. So that was all speculative. Then you get the rise of mathematics and finance, which was there before, but when computerization comes in, it develops a whole new thrust. And slowly but surely, the invention of all these financial devices and speculative variations, and a government that doesn't discourage them, and a period of what I would think of as deregulation and lack of regulation that was just as wide open, we now know, as what the railroads and manufacturing were dealing with in the 1880s and 1890s, so that they could basically run amok. There was no basis for knowing what they were and how to regulate them. And that's what we've got. That's what's imploding at the present time. And we really have to wonder, how far is it going to go? We are being assured now by Wall Street that we have seen the worst. Now, if we haven't seen the worst, then I think one thing we can safely say, Wall Street hasn't seen the worst either, because they're going to be on the receiving end of a huge popular backlash if this has got a couple more layers to go.
Talking about the mathematical models as an example, you've introduced, as others have, a new species on the face of the earth, the black swan.
Oh, dear. Yes.
And this is not an irrelevant new species. You go a little bit further with it, I think, than most people are willing to go. But can we talk about briefly about black swans?
Well, the black swan theory is that with mathematical finance, You have all these people that are the great experts that nothing can go wrong, and that because a black swan cannot occur, the idea is that it's a useful thing to name these things that can't occur but do when the mathematical financiers get going as black swans. Now, they have been breeding, I would say, three or four black swans a decade now, and we've seen these things that have to be bailed out. And
things like...
Oh, you go back, I put a list in the book, I never remember all of them when I have to give the spiel, but you start with the Latin American bonds that were failing in the early 80s, then you go to the SNL bailout, then you go to junk bonds, then you wind up, they bailed out Citigroup, which was then called Citibank, because a bunch of the big banks in the late 80s and early 90s got too far into commercial real estate. Then they bailed out the Mexican peso in 1994. They had the Asian currency and debt crisis and Russian debt crisis 1997 and 98, and they bailed out a hedge fund. And then you had Y2K, and they pumped all this money in case all the computers went nuts. And then the housing bubble.
Well, these are
just
all
relentless.
That's what people recognize.
Yeah.
And if those are the black swans, it seems we have heard.
Yes.
It's a new species. Well, you didn't overtly mention long-term capital management, which was the more or less definitive mathematical construct.
Because
it was predicated on Black-Scholes equations, which are sort of the underpinning view of how financial markets work, and everybody was investing because these were true formulations, and the things that happened to long-term capital management could not happen.
Well,
and, of course, they did happen, and we learned, apparently, nothing.
Help me with the willful naivete of looking at something that just doesn't look, feel, smell, seems too good to be true.
Well, that doesn't faze them, because it hasn't mattered for about a quarter of a century if the financial sector got too reckless, because if they were big enough to matter, they were important enough to be bailed out.
Which is back to that pegging one thing in the system that's not going to be let fail.
It's also true that if people in one sector know that one way or another recklessness is going to be abetted by being rescued, then there's no longer any reason not to push the envelope right up as far as you can go.
So you make money, and then they save you so that you can make more money doing reckless things.
No, you get to the point where even the new innovations are almost automatically reckless. And you reject the cautions that come from the problem with the black swan. You had one in 1998, you had more than one. But you also had, in the crash of 1987, there was something called portfolio insurance. It was another one of these whiz kid type things that couldn't do what it did, but it did it.
Yeah.
And this is the story. They don't worry, or they haven't worried until 2007, that something might go off the tracks because somebody's always there to rescue. Now, the amounts involved have gotten so unbelievable at this point that if more things keep going, it's beyond rescue.
That's a big thing.
The other number that I started to mention was the debt as a percentage of GDP, and you have a chart early on in the book that shows 1928-29, and then comes to the present. Long, it drops off precipitously after, well into the Great Depression, runs along at a level for a while, and then in the 90s just takes off again, and is now, I think, it peaked at, 320%, 325%, which is even higher than the Depression numbers, the numbers preceding the Depression. What I found interesting in looking at that is, when as I was growing up, there was a great deal of talk about guns and butter, and you couldn't have both.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Society, which has taken a great deal of abuse for being, you know, tax and spend, overspending the resources of the great American people, is on the bottom of that curve. It doesn't get ugly until the 90s began and up to more or less the present.
Well, the reason why the Great Society doesn't look like much of a blip is that you can have the foothills look like nothing if you're standing next to Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm.
There really was the beginning in the 1960s, and there were a lot of currency problems and even budget deficit problems in 69, 70, 71. But the really big
movements... The scale is...
In the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's staggeringly, just to give you a quick overview with the numbers, during the time that Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Fed, and he was really Mr. Sort of keep it all fed with liquidity and Mr. bail it out if it's got trouble.
And this is the Federal Reserve Bank Fed.
Absolutely. Federal Reserve Board, which essentially runs much of the banking industry and then is the creator and disposer of American money.
So this is the king we don't ever think about.
It's the the maestro.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that word used for a while. His maestro has sort of dissipated.
Yeah.
But as a measure of Greenspan's tenure from 1987 to 2006, during this time period, what's called credit market debt in the United States, that's tradable, not just a matter of contract. You take it in some place that exists and you trade it, has gone from about $10.6 trillion to, in 2006, about $44 trillion. So you've had more than a quadrupling, and now it's up about $50 trillion. And the funny thing is, the federal government is not the big offender. It's only gone up, and during that same period, it's trebled, perhaps. But the private financial debt has been the fastest-growing thing of all, along with the mortgage part of consumer debt. And you have to take the two together, and they factor in to where the banks in the financial sector are making money. And they needed to get a lot of people to take out what amount to house-related loans. And they needed to borrow a lot of money in the financial sector so that they had the leverage to do all the deals they wanted to do. And that leverage was part of what ballooned from finance from being 16, 17% of GDP up to the 20. You don't want to know. It's like sausage in legislation, what that last 3 to 4 decimal points on the 20 to 21 were.
Well, you may not want to know, but we will find out when we come back with Kevin Phillips. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. Mr. Phillips and I all hope that you'll be with us when we return.